It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about cunning killers and sinister signals. I'm your host, Paul J. McSorley, and tonight and every other Wednesday night, I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of Micah Edwards and Jackson Arthur are Justin Reynolds, Paul J. McSorley, and Rissa Montanez. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our theater of the minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by Micah Edwards and performed by Justin Reynolds. Tonight we air the third installment of the Curdler series, Tales in the West of a Creature and the Man Who Spawned the Myth to Keep the Town Alive. Tales of Anger, Tales of Violence and Terror, Tales of Cannibalism. But the truth of the matter? There's more than myth. Now, without further ado, I present to you More Than Myth.
Gun. Stay in bed, you hear? Stay in bed, Emily, I mean it. Every time something's gotta come along and mess with my fun, I can't get none without some interruption. Every fucking time. Damn. Sid, stay back inside, Em! Coming right back. Jeez. What the? Em, stay inside. Get back yonder. Don't look at it, Em! Shit. Thank you.
Hey there, partner. Come on in. Welcome back. Don't mind me if I take a load off. Been on these hooves since before sunrise, then. This old body of mine ain't what it used to be. C'est la vie, they say in French. At least that's what I heard. Anyway, now that the sun is passing along the horizon, it's time for a little coffin burnish. Oh, pardon my manners. There you be. Cheers. Burns like hell, but it's good for what it does you. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Last we left our story was with a drunken traveler just passing through the valley. When he came across a... well, an encounter, rather, with something that didn't end so well for him. Bit of misfortune, I reckon. There's death afoot. And it's not just the townsfolk who's responsible for this quandary. Something violent is terrorizing the town. This is a story of the Curdler, and a man that will do what he needs to survive. Twice the size of a man it stood, eyes so black that they drank in the surrounding night, claws like two fistful of knives, and a shaggy coat like an entire herd of sheep. By appearance alone, it was monstrous. But it was its shriek that truly set the Curdler apart. A noise so chilling it freeze the blood right in your veins. It was like nothing else. A sound that came from everywhere all at once. It meant death. Once the Curdler screamed, it was all over. That sound heralded the end. Ackerman was proud of that noise. He had taught every person in the town to make it. It rose up from the chest, a full body inhalation that dragged backward against the vocal cords to make an unholy shriek. One person doing it was unnerving. An entire town doing it at once was terrifying. He'd seen seasoned gunfighters freeze in response. He'd watched brave men turn to run. What he'd never seen was the Curdler itself. That was because it wasn't real. He'd made it up to save Avoda Falls. He invented it out of whole cloth, a ruse to lure unsavory men out to a dying town in hopes of bagging a huge reward. It had worked beautifully. The hunters had come, drawn by the promise of an impossible prize. The people of Avoda Falls had lured them in, cut them down, and grown fat upon what they had left behind. And oh, the things they left. Even the ones who were down on their luck carried expensive, well-maintained guns. Avoda Falls had enough arms and ammunition to outfit a revolution. The better-off hunters had horses and fancy clothes and jewelry, all things that sold easily. And they had cash, of course, both coins and paper money. These were not men who trusted banks. They'd seen too many get emptied. Some had even worn the masks. Most of all, though, they left behind meat. In the early days, the town had been lucky to get 50 pounds of meat off of one of the hunters. And they've been glad for it. Countless hours of practice had improved their techniques, and they were now averaging over 70 pounds per hunter. That wasn't even including the animal feed that they could make with the offal. The town's metaphorical fat came from the contents of the hunter's satchels, but the literal fat line in their bellies came from the contents of the hunter's skins. The starving times were now a fading memory. At this point, the people of Avoda Falls had as much food as they could eat, and more wealth than they could spend. If Ackerman had been able to, he would have shut the operation down. He would have closed up the lodging house and shut down the blood-soaked church where they harvested the bodies. He would have even taken away the train station itself, that ill-omened platform where so many had arrived and so few had left. The story of the Curdler was no easier to stop than the train itself, though. The hunters kept coming in, gripping crumpled, worn copies of the posters that the townsfolk had made. It had been more than half a year since any new ones had gone out, yet somehow they just kept circulating. Ackerman tried telling a group that the Curdler was gone once.
Gone where?
Gone. Dead. A man killed it last week. Name of Davis.
Well, where is he?
How should I know? He took the reward money, got back on the train the next day, and was gone. I imagine you'll find him in a saloon somewhere.
What are we supposed to do?
Well, maybe there's more of them nearby. Come on, we can go out searching.
They went out armed and angry, and came back frustrated and vicious. They got drunk at the saloon and fired on Cork when he tried to cut them off. He huddled behind his bar while they smashed the place around him, and Ackerman had to organize a group to gun them down. Here you go, Dad. Even drunk, the hunters were dangerous, and several men were shot before Avoda Falls took the last of them down. After that, no one tried to turn the hunters away. It just wasn't safe. Besides, though no one would say it directly, Avoda Falls had grown used to their lifestyle. Carving the flesh from the bodies was gruesome work, to be sure, but it was no harder than farming the arid land than it had been. It paid far better as well. Also, the taste of human meat had begun to have a certain appeal. The people of his small town pretended to regret the necessity, but Ackerman noticed that no one had brought a cow to him to butcher for months now, even for the variety. Animal meat lacked the flavor they'd all come to expect, to need even. Ackerman knew that it couldn't go on forever. They were killing too many these days, even if no one ever slipped up and let one escape. There had been several close calls already. Someone would notice eventually. In the end, they would be caught. He had a plan in place, assuming they had any warning. He would bundle his town onto the train and disperse them out west, letting them fade into small towns of the wilder parts of the country by ones and twos. Avoda Falls had never had a proper census. There was no proof of who had lived there. They could take their gains and vanish, living the rest of their lives as proper ladies and gentlemen, or squandering it in a year on sins and debauchery, for all Ackerman cared. Either way, Avoda Falls would be gone, and there would be no one to stand for its crimes. It was possible, of course, that the lawmen would come without notice, if Avoda Falls was unaware that their secret had leaked. And if a clever planner was the one who had gotten wind of their lifestyle, then the first warning might be a train full of soldiers with guns at the ready. Ackerman held no illusions about how the outer world felt about cannibalism. Killing a man to survive was fine. Eating him for the same reason was a horror. Even in that situation, though, Ackerman thought that Avoda Falls might have one more surprise. The town had gotten good at killing. Every man, woman, and child carried a long knife as a matter of habit now, and there were regular competitions to see who could hit the distant targets the best and the fastest. The theoretical soldiers would have training, but he doubted they expected to be gunned down by a 7-year-old girl clutching a doll. It would be casualties, certainly. But Ackerman was confident that the majority of his town would still survive and scatter. It was funny how it had become his town. It had just been a town until everything went wrong. When the river had dried up, he had been just another man trying to get by. He'd fallen into leadership almost completely by accident. If it weren't for the story of the Curdler, none of this would have happened. Ackerman wondered sometimes if he had invented the Curdler, or if it had invented him. Every time the new hunters arrived calling him mayor and repeating his own tall tales back to him, every piece grown and exaggerated in the retellings, it seemed harder to say. Neither of them were quite real, it seemed to him. He and the Curdler were both stories. For a long time, he thought that they were the same story. Lately, though, the Curdler seemed to be taking on a life of its own. Hunters came in talking about details that Ackerman had never invented. They spoke of the ragged wings that dragged behind it, sweeping its footprints away. They talked about its boneless nature, allowing it to squeeze into unreasonable small spaces. They told him that his town was only the latest in a series to be plagued by the creature, that it had been working its way across the west. They said it feared fire, though they were mixed on whether it was the heat or the light that it shied away from. Some even claimed to have killed one before. One man showed Ackerman a pelt as proof.
Look at the patterns. Much better than pure black for hunting at night. All those shades of gray blend better with the shadows than any single color ever could. Makes it hard to pick out the shape when it's moving until it rears up. This one had a blaze of white on its belly. That flash of white was all the warning I had got before it screamed. I tell you straight, I got lucky that night. I had my gun up as soon as I saw that white fur. But it let out a scream before I could fire. Every muscle in my body locked up. I was just fortunate enough that I got it square in my sights first. When my hands clenched, it pulled the trigger for me. My aim was good, even if I was slow on the draw. I hit him right in the heart. I dropped to the ground instantly, but it was still a full minute before I could make myself go over there and confirm it was dead. I nearly unloaded the rest of my gun into it to make for sure. But to be honest, I wanted that pelt. I wanted it.
The story amused Ackerman greatly. The details, the assurance with which he related the impossible tale. If Ackerman hadn't personally invented the Curdler, he might truly have believed that this man had fought one. Ackerman killed him himself to make sure it was done right. He liked the man, but he had been a butcher long before he was the mayor of Evota Falls, and he was pragmatic before all else. The rule was simple. No one who knew of the Curdler left Evota Falls alive. Not the hunters who come chasing the figment. Not the townsfolk who knew the bloody truth it hid. No one. There were fewer than a dozen of the residents that Ackerman had trusted even to put up the posters, back when they had to work to lure the hunters in. He knew it'd be too tempting for some, once they'd taken the first step away from Evota Falls, to simply keep going. He sent folks with families, folks who had something to come back to. Even then, he'd made a mistake once. A man named Andreas had left one morning, packed just like he was only going out for the day, leaving his wife, his farm, and all his worldly possessions behind. Ackerman had missed the signs. It was as surprised as anyone when Andreas didn't return on the evening train. He hid his concern, but the next morning, he went out hunting. It took him 3 days to find Andreas. The man was holed up in an inn in the middle of a city 6 hours away. He didn't ask how Ackerman had tracked him down, or looked surprised to see him. He only said,
"Please, I can't go back."
"On that we agree.
Make it quick.
Quick as I can. But I need to know. If you told anyone..."
"No one!"
"I didn't ask what yet."
A knife was in Ackerman's hand. He closed the door as he advanced into Andreas's room.
"About the Curdler."
"No one."
"And where are you
you came from.
I didn't.
About what we've done to survive.
I haven't even used my real name.
I hope that's all true. This'll go faster if I don't catch you in any lies.
It took most of the day, but in the end, Ackerman was satisfied that Andreas had not spilled any of the secrets of Avoda Falls. He left most of what remained on the runway in the scrubby inn, where he attempted to hide. He brought back only the man's left hand, his wedding band still on it. He told the town that the curdler had killed Andreas. They all understood, even his widow. The curdler was a necessary evil, and a lesser one. At least it had been. Ackerman was no longer entirely certain about that second qualifier. He knew that the curler had never been fully under his control. He had invented the story, but even the first ambush involved half the town. He had directed the initial operations of the abattoir they had built in the church, but it had been months since he had walked through those doors, let alone done any of the butchering himself. Its namesake scream was only affected because it came from so many people at once. Still, the first time he found that someone had been killed by the curdler, when he hadn't done it, it made him nervous. Angry, too. In a way he couldn't quite explain. Like they'd taken something away from him. Worse was that when he asked around, suddenly, so as not to raise suspicion that he didn't already know what had happened, no one seemed to know who had done it. Will had needed to die. No question about it. He fancied himself clever, and had started up a game recently where he'd slyly hint to the hunters what was in store for them. Ackerman had warned him about it, but Will claimed that lines like, "Can't wait to see you in church on Sunday," couldn't possibly tip the hunters off, as they had no idea what the town's church was now for. When Ackerman had told him that it wasn't up for debate, Will had sullenly agreed to quit, but after a week or so, he'd started up again. Shortly after that, he was gone. The front door of his house was smashed in, and a bloody trail led out into the desert. Ackerman followed it and found what was left of Will's body at the end. The smaller animals had gotten at it, but it was clear that the lethal damage had been inflicted by something much larger. The side of his head was crushed in. Most of his right side was gone. The protruding ribs looked as if they'd been bitten through. There wasn't enough of him left undamaged to salvage at the Red Church. Ackerman left the body there in the desert, but he brought the questions with him back to town. No one had answers, though. All they knew was that the curdler had done it. It grew worse. Hunters began disappearing during the nightly kills. Ackerman panicked at the first one, certain that someone had finally managed to escape. The town never did find the hunter, but they found the blood-soaked rags that had been in his clothes. Ackerman considered that the man could have left those to throw the town off his scent. But his gun was there, too. It was holstered and still had every chamber loaded. The gunslinger had never fired a single shot. A week or so later, another one was taken. The girl who had been tasked with watching him claimed that as soon as the curdler's scream went up from around the town, he vanished. Something sped out of the night and tackled him in that frozen moment, whisking him away in the blink of an eye. It happened more and more frequently. The town didn't mind.
We have more than enough to eat now,
said the barman, Cork, in response to Ackerman's questioning.
What does it matter if we don't recover every single body?
What matters is that they're being taken. Aren't you worried? Aren't you at least curious?
The way I figure, we've taken enough in the curdler's name. Seems only fair if he starts taking his cut.
But the curdler doesn't exist.
Cork only shrugged. He had seen and done too many strange things at this point. He couldn't balk at one more. It bothered Ackerman, though. He had never been under the illusion that he fully controlled the curdler, but he had thought that he was steering it at least. Someone else was taking the reins, changing the narrative. Without knowing who was behind it, Ackerman could not be certain where they were heading. He did not like being in the dark. His creation was too dangerous to be allowed to slip away. He began to take a more active role in the hunts again, hoping to catch the perpetrator in action. He reviewed the hunters on arrival, sizing them up, judging which one was most likely to be taken. It was the most arrogant ones he found, the ones who boasted the loudest, laughed the hardest, sneered the most. They were the ones the curdler targeted. Whoever was doing it was operating within the established rules. They struck in the darkness, immediately followed by the blood-curdling scream. They carried their prey off in an instant. They moved like a shadow in the night and left no footprints, only a clean-swept trail. And the few pieces of bodies that Ackerman found looked to have been torn free by claws or teeth. He accounted for the whereabouts of all of Yvota Falls during these abductions. He knew that there had been no hunters who had survived. It had to be someone from the outside. Someone using the town's murder smith for their own purposes. But why? And what did they want? The questions ate away at Ackerman. He slept less and less. He took to sulking around the town at odd hours, hoping to catch something. He did not even know what he was looking for. A stash costume, perhaps. Spattered blood. Anything out of place. Anything that would let him know who was controlling the story. One night as the hunt began, Ackerman found himself in the Red Church, standing near what had once been the altar. Rows of bloodstained tables stretched away from him. Barrels of salted meat were stacked in the corners. Bones boiled in huge black kettles, replacing the crisp night air with a muggy, oppressive heat. Knives gleamed brightly at every station, eager to feast on the bodies that would soon arrive. Out in the town, the curdler scream went up. Ackerman added his own voice to the mix, pouring out his frustration, rage, and fear. It was a promise and a challenge, a threat and a command. And in that instant, something unfolded from the shadows by the double doors of the church and screamed back at him. Ackerman felt his heart stop in his chest. The sound the town made was a paltry imitation compared to this. The shriek of the monster before him evoked true, pure horror. It was everything Ackerman had ever known it could be. The feeling that raced through him was equal parts terror and awe. It stalked down the aisle toward Ackerman, ragged wings whispering quietly along the floor behind it. It hunched slightly, as if unsure whether even the high ceilings of the church gave it ample room to stand. Lantern light played over the mottled patterns of its fur, but its eyes reflected nothing at all. They were deep black pits leering from its misshapen face. It moved slowly, deliberately. The initial shock released Ackerman from its grasp, but a quick glance around showed him that he had nowhere to go. He snatched up his lantern and flung it at the creature, but it ducked in a sudden liquid motion. The lantern sailed overhead and crashed against the wooden doors of the church. Flaming oil streamed down and puddled on the floor. The cheap paint on the walls bubbled, blistered, and caught fire. Still, the curdler came, step by inexorable step. Ackerman snatched his gun from his holster, but suddenly the creature was there in front of him, swatting it aside. The gun spun off into the church, clinging off one of the kettles. Ackerman swore, grabbed his bleeding hand, and fell back a step.
You turn on me? I made you up. You're a story, a device. You lure the weak-minded and the easily gulled. You're a distraction to keep the cattle from looking at the knives. And you come to me here, in my town, in my...
taste my blood?
The monster lunged again, but Ackerman grabbed a knife from a table nearby and met its charge with a stab of his own. It shrieked as the blade pierced its chest. Ackerman slammed its mouth shut with a vicious uppercut.
I invented that noise.
The two figures circled each other, knives and claws both dripping with blood.
You don't get to use it on me. You're nothing but a slice of what I am. A beast that I dreamed up. You're nothing next to me. What are you? A bogeyman? Tall tale. What have you survived? I grew up poor and desperate. I killed to survive long before I ever came to Avoda Falls. I was happy to leave my past behind. Happy to be just a quiet butcher. But when they dammed the river and dammed the town, I wasn't about to lay down and die. I told the world about you, but you weren't the real killer. I was. I killed the preacher. I killed the men we lured here. I killed my own people when I had to keep the town safe. And you think a figment? A mind script? A thing? Can just rise up and take that from me? You think I'll just step aside and let that happen? I've seen worse than you on 10,000 different mornings. All right. Why don't you step in a little closer? I'll show you how deep this blade cuts.
Curler fell upon him in earnest then, a cavalcade of twisted claws and jagged teeth. Ackerman roared as his back was flayed open, his shoulders punctured and shaken. He fought back, knives in both hands now, slashing and stabbing. He had been a butcher long before he had been made mayor. The knives were alive in his grip, springing forward to bury themselves in flesh again and again. Flames flashed up from the church as the two brawled. Claws against knives and fur against skin, all tangled up in the sweeping, ragged wings. The curdler bit down on Ackerman's neck. Hot blood surged out to add to the stains on the floor. Ackerman, screaming, did not pull away, but instead wrapped his arms around the monster's lower head. He buried his knives at either side of its neck. The curdler reared up, hoisting Ackerman from the ground. Pain spasmed through his body as it shook him back and forth, trying to dislodge the knives. He could feel the blood coursing down his chest. Far too much of it. He did not know how much was his and how much was the curdler's. Enough to mortally wound them both, he thought. Despite the raging fire, the room was darkening around him. Ackerman felt his feet hit the floor as the curdler sank to its knees. Longer support his own weight. He and the monster fell to the floor together, still wrapped in their deadly embrace. The last thing Ackerman saw as the darkness closed in was the monster's eyes, still blacker than even the infinite night. By the time the townsfolk of Avoda Falls got to the church, the fire was far beyond anything they could hope to control. They could only stand and watch as their terrible livelihood burned away. It consumed the meat and blood as ravenously as the people themselves had, and left almost nothing behind. When the ashes had cooled, there was nothing left but the big kettles, dozens of twisted knives, and one skeleton right in the middle of everything. It was so warped and blackened by the fire that it was difficult to tell if it was even human. As no one could find Ackerman, though, the town put two and two together. They could have rebuilt, of course. They still had the train line bringing them fresh prey. They had more than enough money. Instead, without a single word spoken, the people of Avoda Falls went home to pack up their lives. They drifted off to different places. Some established themselves as people of means and spent the rest of their days at leisure. Some drank and fought themselves into a grave within the year. None of them ever spoke of the starving times in Avoda Falls.
and what they had to do to survive. I never forgot how much longer it went on. Out in the West, men still hunt the curdler.
I hope you enjoyed More Than Myth, as written by Micah Edwards, with the performance, production, and music by Justin Reynolds. Parts 1 and 2 of this trilogy can be found in our archives. Part 1 aired during episode 186, and Part 2 aired during episode 220. Our second tale of the evening is brought to us by our friends at Velox Books. Is written by Jackson Arthur and performed by Terry Hudson, Danielle Hewitt, and Paul J. McSorley. In it, we meet two friends indulging in one of the best rites of passage that there is, a road trip. Now, without further ado, I present to you The Unexpected Friend.
This evening, like most of the evenings over the past 5 years, Sky is traveling an all-too-familiar route toward Orwell, Ohio, a nothing little town where one could spot as many Amish buggies as motor vehicles on the road. In that nothing town, like a lot of nothing towns in northeastern Ohio, there's a large factory. And like most people that live in northeastern Ohio, Sky is a factory worker. Living the American dream. For the third week in a row, her bosses are forcing her into yet another mandatory weekend. She is ready for a day off. She needs it like she needs oxygen. For the love of whatever god or devil might be looking out for the factory workers of Ohio, she is beyond ready for a night of camping and drinking and carrying on. Sky groans quietly before deciding to suck it up.
What was that?
A voice asks from the passenger seat. Sky glances at Bethany. The fading sun pierces the windshield and casts a bar of light at the top of Bethany's head, which bears a slight resemblance to either a halo or a crown. Huh?
You sighed.
I did not.
You totally sighed just now. I'm just busting your balls, I get it. I feel the same. Another Saturday night in that shithole is too freaking much.
I want to go camping so bad. You camp?
Sleep on the ground? Pass.
Trust me, you won't mind the ground because you will be way too drunk to feel anything by then.
Truth. I'll still pass on that, though. I do wish we were going somewhere else, though. Bar, club, strip club, Key West. Anywhere but back to flippin' work for the 1,000th time. Blows. At least Steve is gonna be the floor supervisor.
Sky gives Bethany another swift glance, her eyes bugging out of her head. Right? He is so sexy.
Yes, he is. He can supervise my floor anytime. Along with my couch, my bed, and my shower. And my countertops while he's at it.
Nodding along, Sky adds, yeah, Mr. Fine can even supervise the backseat of this car if he wanted. Bethany responds with another giggle before exploding into full roaring laughter.
I might just have to carpool with you on that shit, too. You know, bang, bang, bang.
Gross! You're gonna have to wait your turn, nasty girl. Bethany is petite, with smooth skin. Her dark, black hair naturally forms curls that are both bouncy and playful. The smooth skin of Bethany's youthful face is spotted by clusters of tiny freckles. In Skye's opinion, Bethany resembles an old-time, classic-style porcelain doll, similar to the type that Skye's Nana used to collect. Along with resembling a porcelain doll, Bethany also speaks with a squeaky, childlike voice. Bethany's appearance gives the misleading illusion that she is sweet, innocent, and perhaps a little naive. Skye had almost bought into the illusion at first. Yet, after getting to know Bethany, she recognized that the resemblance of being childlike and sweet went only skin deep. It is an unintentional mask that Bethany is forced to wear. Bethany is perverted, blunt, honest, loud, far from innocent, and absolutely hilarious. And after 3 months of carpooling, Skye is no longer a bit surprised by any of the dirty things that often spill from Bethany's lips. And it always makes the often grueling ride to work into something somewhat bearable. How did I ever get stuck riding with your bitch ass every single day?
Could be fate. Could be luck. Or it could be a plot to abduct and sell your firm ass as a sex slave that has gone on way too long. Only God knows that shit.
Truth. Or it could be that your dumbass truck broke down on your second day, and I took pity on your sorry broke behind enough to swoop to the rescue. Because I am selfless and awesome like a superhero. Like I'm the Supergirl of Northeastern Ohio. Or maybe Wonder Woman. Or some other awesome heroine who wears spandex outside no matter the season. Or something. Bethany nods.
Or something.
But luckily for you, you also just happen to live in the same town as me, and I just happen to go right by your apartment on my way. Or else you might have been screwed. I mean, I might be totally selfless and heroic, but I really hate backtracking, you know?
Same.
Hell yeah, I love this song. Quickly, she removes a hand from the wheel and boosts the volume on her Sirius radio up a few notches. The opening chords to Melissa begin. Not only does she hum along with the sad, crying guitars, but Skye also launches into vocals, singing along with the first verse. Crossroads seem to come and go. Not long after upgrading her Honda's standard stereo system to satellite radio, Skye discovered a station titled Crossroads, a channel entirely dedicated to the Allman Brothers Band and other similar classic rock bands. It was like winning the lottery. Classic rock and roll, especially the Allman Brothers Band, always reminds Skye of camping, her childhood, and her father. As the final notes of the song play, Skye reaches to turn the music back down. She is suddenly halted by an unexpected explosion of terrible sound, an onslaught of vicious static that savagely erupts throughout the speakers. The wicked detonation draws a startled shriek from Bethany. For several seconds, the sharp clamor slices and cuts at Skye's brain. She fights to connect her scattered thoughts. Somehow, she manages to piece together one clear and obvious question. Can satellite radios even get static? Just when Skye is certain that the bones of her skull are about to shatter beneath the white noise that beats against them, the static stops. She manages to loosen a lung full of air, unsure at what point she began holding her breath. The following silence is like a glimpse of heaven, but it is short-lived. Skye expects her radio to return to normal and loud music to resume, but that does not happen. Instead, something happens that confuses Skye even more. A single man, a single resounding voice, firing off urgent words like thundering gunshots, bombarding the speakers at a rapid pace.
Please, don't turn me off. Please. You need to listen.
Beneath the words, Skye can easily identify stress and desperation in the man's voice. She brings the volume down to a reasonable tone, but for some reason does not switch stations or turn the radio off. She glances at Bethany, wondering if her passenger is feeling the same confusion. Meeting Sky's gaze, Bethany asks,
"Is he a DJ?"
"Sirius Radio wouldn't have a DJ, remember? It only has music. That's why I have to pay $10 a month."
"Who is he then?"
"I have no clue."
"It hasn't begun yet. The invasion has. But not the war. Not yet. We still have time. But not much, I'm afraid."
The frantic man continues,
"So, I need to be quick. As children, we are taught, all of us, to be wary of strangers. Don't talk to them. They will hurt us. Wrong. We have been wrong the whole time. We have been afraid of the wrong people. It won't be strangers that get us."
"What a psycho,"
Bethany states, before asking Sky to change the station.
"Invasion never happens like in movies."
"Right? I don't know why people buy into this conspiracy bullshit."
"There won't be any grand invading force."
"Yeah, what a loser."
"That is not how it will happen."
"Please turn off this garbage,"
Bethany asks again, gradually growing more aggressive each time.
"It's giving me a headache."
Sky continues to ignore her requests, though, as the man drones on.
"It will not come in the form of an approaching army at our gates, because the enemy will not be using brute blunt force. They are smarter than that. And the invasion is already happening. Look all around you. The nice new couple that recently moved into the neighborhood two houses down from you. The new handsomer, cute employee at your job. The beautiful girl at the local shop and save who begins to flirt back. The unexpected friend."
"New couple, cute employee? What? What does that even mean?" Sky wonders. "An unexpected friend? Most friends are unexpected to a point. That could mean anything. Anyone. Unexpected friend? It could even mean someone like Bethany?" The voice continues,
"I am not crazy. The invasion has already begun. It's too late to go back and stop it now. The clock is winding down, but it has not reached 0 hour yet."
0 hour?
"Right under our noses, in plain sight, the enemies have been making their moves. Slowly sliding their pieces into place over the past, I'm not entirely sure how long. Too long. And they are not only infiltrating places of power, they are also casually inserting themselves into the lives of everyday people. Like you. Into your neighborhoods. Into your jobs. Into your inner circles. In time, they will be everywhere. And when the time comes to strike, there will be no stopping them. It's a drawn-out strategy from a very patient foe. By very slowly tightening their grasp around us, we would remain blind and oblivious to the fact the enemy had grabbed onto us until our life is suddenly squeezed away."
"I'll just turn the shit off myself,"
Bethany exclaims as she reaches for the radio's power button.
"And it would have worked, too."
Mindless reaction causes Sky to slap Bethany's hand away, drawing a startled cry of outrage. "What is your problem?"
"What the fuck is your problem?"
"Why do you want me to turn it off so bad? You are acting weird. Why can't you just chill out?"
"But their entire plan hinged on one thing. The ability to move unseen until everything is in place."
Something nags at Sky from the back of her mind, something that she is obviously missing. But what?
"They slipped up."
With his next words, Sky witnesses the man's voice taking on a new quality, a new tone, one seemingly on the edge of pure insanity.
"And now I can see them."
Unlike the previous attempt, Bethany does not speak or give Sky any warning before she lunges her hand toward the console of the radio. Sky again reacts, slapping at Bethany's moving arm. But this time, Sky is unable to react fast enough to keep Bethany's finger from hitting its target. The button is pushed. The radio channel changes. But it doesn't matter, because the single voice follows them. Bethany pushes the button again and again and again, but the man's voice is everywhere. This places the final piece into the puzzle. Sky asks aloud, "If this is just some nut job, how the hell would he be able to hijack my satellite radio?" As if answering Sky's question,
"I am using satellites and the internet to send my message across the globe. Televisions, smartphones, smart tablets, video game systems, streaming services like Hulu or Netflix, XM radio. I will send myself as far as the reaches of our technology will take me. Anywhere I can get the word out. Some of you are hearing my voice. Some of you can see my face. I don't know how long I will be able to continue reaching you before they silence me. I am afraid, but I will no longer hide. My name is Dr. Wesley Brandt, and I'm trying to save you all."
Is this even possible? Sky then notices a set of bright headlights from an approaching vehicle heading their direction along the opposite lane. As the dark SUV passes them, she wonders if the same strange man is speaking to them, too. Bethany desperately pounds down on the station button several more times, but Dr. Brandt speaks out from every channel, like a preacher spouting scripture from an altar that is raised high and far from reach. Sky takes her eyes from the road and glances at Bethany. "Why is she acting so strange right now?" Sky questions. "Acting a little erratic. Why is she so desperate to shut off Dr. Brandt?"
"I have seen our invaders,"
Dr. Brandt goes on.
"And they are cunning and clever. They do not have the strength to attack with brute force. So instead, they are using the shadows and our tunnel vision against us. They are dangerous, but they are also weak and cowardly, and they have chosen to move behind our backs instead of meeting us face to face, but not any longer."
As Sky is looking at Bethany, something bewildering happens. At first, Sky is unsure whether it is real, but Bethany seems to alter, to change in some bizarre way. The change does not happen physically, and if she were later asked to do so, Sky would find it near impossible to describe this change in words.
"I have seen them, and I need you to see them too. Open your eyes and listen to my words. Look with an open mind. The invaders are all around you. Once everyone else, the rest of you around the world, sees them too, we can then begin to fight."
If Sky had to explain this change to another person, it would be like this. Across the surface of Bethany's pale, porcelain-like exterior, thin, metaphorical fissures began to crack apart and spread. As the fissures become wide, gaping crevices, Sky is able to see below the disguise. Then, as Bethany's shell crumbles away, Sky is no longer looking at the same person that has been her carpooling buddy for the past few months.
"You must."
Sky has always known that Bethany's innocent, doll-like appearance isn't true to the person beneath it. Just like how a beautiful, precious puppy will chew your favorite shoes, rip up the trash, and piss all over the furniture the minute no one is watching. But as the outer shell of her friend falls away, Sky is left with something truly unexpected.
"Can you see them?"
A complete stranger.
"Can you see them?"
A silent invader. As Sky stares at Bethany, she realizes that Bethany is staring back. Their eyes meet, and something passes unseen between them. Without warning, Bethany reaches over and grabs hold of the steering wheel. A brief tug of war for control over the vehicle ends with the Honda sharply swerving, violently lunging over the white edge line and off the road. From the blackness of the night, a broad tree materializes directly in their path. Headlights spill across the surface of the thick trunk, forming large glowing orbs. Somehow, Sky manages to find the brake with her left foot. thrusting down onto the pedal with as much force as her leg muscles are capable of, Sky fails to keep the Honda from wrapping around the solid base of the tall tree. During the collision, Sky nearly blacks out. Visually, everything falls away, a total eclipse of her sight. Her other senses, however, fully experience the 2 seconds that take place between the instant her car smashes into the tree and the moment when it succumbs to the undeniably violent stop. Metal savagely twists, bends, and implodes as the front end hammers home. Sky's seatbelt, which had been buckled out of habit, instantaneously tightens its grip on her. Lungs deflate, and ribs fracture. The windshield disintegrates in a clap of thunder before slivers of glass rain across her like sharp hail. A massive crash fills her ears like the detonation of a grenade when her airbag inflates. Hitting the airbag feels more like hitting the side of a brick wall. The cartilage of her nose bends and nearly caves in, but somehow keeps from snapping. And her neck pops from bottom to top, luckily without breaking. Sky doesn't have time to be paralyzed by pain, though. She needs to act. She needs to move. But the first thing that she needs to do is catch her breath, no matter how damaged her ribs are or how much oxygen feels like razors. Her eyes shoot open. Instincts scream for her to get out of the car. Run! Run! However, when Sky shifts her body toward the door, the locked seatbelt restricts her movements. Reaching down, she tries to disengage it, but during the collision, the latch somehow jammed. Like Bethany with the buttons on the radio, Sky jabs at it with her thumb, over and over and over, but the belt won't release. Claustrophobia threatens to squeeze away her willpower as she frantically fights to free herself from the simple contraption. Right when Sky borders on insanity, she remembers that her utility knife is in the front right pocket of her khaki pants. The razor is worn and mostly dulled from work, but it should be sharp enough to cut through the seatbelt. Sky pulls the knife free, but then hears coughing and hacking from the passenger seat. Somehow, in her frenzy to get loose, Sky forgot about Bethany, who appears to be returning to consciousness. The two girls suddenly lock eyes. Like a leaping python, Bethany instantly lunges toward Sky. Bethany never wanted to wear her seatbelt, no matter how much Sky lectured her. But that lack of restraint provides Bethany enough mobility to wrap Sky in a firm headlock. Sky frantically digs her stubby fingernails into the flesh of her attacker's arms, struggling violently and fiercely against her narrowing airway. She forces herself to inhale as hard and as deeply as possible, taking in whatever wisps of air that she might squeeze down her throat before it closes completely. Faint, lingering smoke slides into her lungs, along with drops of blood from her bleeding nose, which burns her airway, causing her to gasp and choke.
Why are you doing this? Please, just...
Sky is unsure whether or not Bethany hears her low, raspy pleads, because she doesn't receive an answer. Instead, Bethany shouts...
You need to quit. You need to just quit this shit.
But Sky isn't quitting. She is going to fight back, like Dr. Brandt says. Swiftly, Sky throws her fists and elbows at Bethany, hoping that one good hit might loosen the hold on her throat. But the attacks are awkward and make little difference. Bethany clumsily jerks at Sky's upper body as she tries to pull Sky over to her own seat, most likely to gain better leverage. But luckily, the seatbelt remains jammed and locked and refuses to let go of Sky, like the incorruptible hug of a guardian angel. Abruptly, Sky halts her arms from their mindless flailing. She forces a shallow, agony and blood-filled breath in order to regain her mental composure. Panic has clouded her mind, and she has forgotten about her utility knife. which she still grasps. With a push of her thumb, the blade slides free. Ferociously, Skye thrusts the exposed blade toward Bethany's leg. The razor is worn and dull, yet it sinks effortlessly into Bethany's flesh. At once, a bubble of dark blood rises from the wound and then quickly flows down Bethany's leg in a narrow stream. A wounded leg does not stop Bethany. Rather than reestablishing the same tight hold, Bethany pulls away her right arm, leaving only a single left arm wrapped around Skye's throat. The hold is loose, slightly weaker, but with her free arm, Bethany begins an awkward attempt at seizing the utility knife from Skye's grasp, grabbing and smacking, tugging and tearing, jerking and wrenching, pulling, pulling, and pulling. Skye does everything in her power to keep Bethany from getting a finger on the weapon. Yet, because Bethany has the upper hand, Skye is outmatched and overpowered. She needs to fight smarter. Skye slows the hand holding the razor knife and allows Bethany to loosely wrap fingers around her wrist. While Bethany pulls on Skye's arm, Skye gathers what little vigor she has left. Passionately, Skye screams through a wide, gaping mouth as she grabs hold of her own arm with her free hand. Using not just the muscles of her arms, but those of her upper body, her shoulders and back, Skye pulls upward, toward her chest, toward her aching lungs, toward her center of gravity. Surprisingly, Skye's tired arms are able to bring the knife level to her heart. She pulls and pulls until she simply can't pull any further. And then, without warning, Skye pushes. Caught off guard by the unexpected shift in momentum, Bethany is helpless to stop the blade of the utility knife from plunging squarely into the middle of her chest. Before Bethany has the chance to recover, Skye stabs her several more times in the upper body. Silent shock and rushing death fill Bethany's face, making her unable to speak or cry out. Skye doesn't bother to wipe away the sticky layer of blood coating the razor blade. Instead, she finally frees herself from the seatbelt. After forcing open the battered car door, Skye fumbles out in an exhausted and beaten heap. As the river of adrenaline pumping and pounding through her veins dries up, the simple desire to survive keeps Skye moving, rather than folding into a fetal position. Somehow, Skye manages to rise to her feet. Glancing at the crushed and disfigured chunk of metal that had once been her Honda, Skye fights the urge to vomit. Turning from rubble, she slowly stumbles and crosses the handful of yards, dividing her crushed car and the side of the two-lane road. The full moon, hanging in the clear sky, pours down unhindered beams of light. By that light, Skye can see that she is standing at the edge of a dense and shadowy stretch of woods. On the opposite side of the road is a massive, open field. The piece of land is obviously familiar to Skye after having driven by it on 1,000 different occasions while on her way to work. A white, three-story house sits to the left of the open field. Even though the house is 100 or so yards back from the road, the large, looming structure and its adjacent red barn can easily be seen from the road. In the mornings, Skye would sometimes see the Amish family that lives there. Children running and playing, plain women gardening or hanging laundry, strong men tending and farming the field. The familiarity of her surroundings places much-needed ground beneath Skye's feet. She no longer feels like she is free-falling. From the direction of the Amish farm, Skye detects faint voices in the air. She then notices orbs of light, possibly flashlights, moving in a group toward her. They must have heard the crash. The sight of the approaching Amish family suddenly fills Skye with a harrowing sense of dread and the frantic urgency of purpose. Dr. Brandt explained that he had hijacked satellites and the internet in order to warn people. But the Amish, even the more evolved families, don't generally use devices like smartphones or televisions that are connected to the internet, or radio systems that are linked to satellites, or anything else of that nature. They have no idea what is going on. Their world is no longer the same, and they need to know. The invasion, the secret war, they need to know about all of it. Is it up to her to warn them? Sky wonders. Like Dr. Brandt, has the burden fallen onto her shoulders as well? Sky has always believed that there would be plenty of time for tents and camping and cold beer and menthol cigarettes and the Allman Brothers. She is young, has a long life ahead of her. But she has been wrong all along. She was never aware that the clock had been counting down the entire time. And now, in the blink of an eye, the clock has reached 0 hour. As Sky hobbles, painfully jogging across the road and toward the approaching lights, questions shout from the very back parts of her mind. What if these people already know what is happening somehow? What if they know? Because they are also silent invaders, like Bethany. Sky tightens her grasp on the utility knife she still holds and continues forward.
I hope you enjoyed The Unexpected Friend, as written by Jackson Arthur and performed by Terry Hudson, Danielle Hewitt, and Paul J. McSorley. On to the shows. Longtime resident Otis Gyre has his very own show here on our network, Scary Stories Told in the Dark, which you can hear every Sunday night. We also have Eric Peabody's Horror Hill, a podcast dedicated to some of our deeper and darker tales. We hope you check him out. And Drew Blood's Dark Tales airs Fridays, featuring some Southern down-home horror. And don't forget to check out the Fear from the Heartland archives, featuring more than 120 episodes. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us tonight. I'm your host of the evening, Paul J. McSorley, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.